Welcome to the Six Figure Developer Podcast, the podcast where we talk about new and exciting technologies, professional development, clean code, career advancement, and more. I'm John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.
Our guest today is Jonathan Stark. Jonathan is a former software developer who is now on a mission to rid the world of hourly billing. He is the author of Hourly Billing is Nuts, the host of Ditching Hourly, and writes a daily newsletter on pricing for independent professionals. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hey guys, thanks for having me.
So before we get started, would you mind just like sort of telling us about yourself, how you got started in the industry and such?
Sure. I mean, it goes way back. My dad got the original IBM PC in like 81, and I started coding BASIC when I was, you know, really young, maybe 12, 11 or 12, 13 around there, you know, making like ASCII animation art and that sort of thing, you know, go to line 80. And then I got away from it for a long time. I really fell in love with electric guitar, did that for a long time, but I kept getting pulled back into computers. Even when I was in a band, we needed somebody to manage the mailing list. So I got a laptop from somebody and an Access database on it. And I was doing mail merges, and I'd go to Kinko's and print them out and send them actual stamps in the mail. For years, I went to Berkeley, got a music degree. And for years, I did the musician thing, but always I was doing computers in the background, whether it was for postcards or for, you know, freelance gigs, doing like Quark Express at, you know, to build catalogs, paper catalogs. So you can tell I'm a little bit gray, you know, going back to computers in the 90s, pre-internet stuff. And eventually I landed a job. I converted sort of a freelance job into an in-house job at Staples headquarters in Framingham, Mass. I worked in their advertising department, and I was a DBA, so database stuff. Really loved it. Was super into databases. I came in through Access and FileMaker, started getting into SQL, and then around 2003, I didn't go on my own, but I left there, and I went into a boutique FileMaker firm, really successful one in Atlanta, moved down there, and ended up managing that place. I was the VP there, you know, usually around 10 to 15 developers that all build hourly. And we made custom database software for all sorts of clients all over the world, big, small, and in between. And while I was there, it was my job to make sure the hours get, you know, all the developers, get your hours in. We have to send out invoices or we're not going to make payroll, you know. You know, I spent tons of time talking about hours. All I would talk about is hours. I was the person or one of the main people who would do estimates for new clients. So like, we think it's going to be this many hours. And then that many hours later would be halfway done. So they'd be yelling at us and we'd be, you know, like, well, you know, these are, you know, they'd be like, why did this take so long this week? And it didn't take that long last week. And we just talked about hours all the time, building internal systems to track hours and turn them into invoice hours. We got to the point where I was at a sort of an impasse because it became evident that our best developer, who was really fast, wrote immaculate code, could jump into the most complex customer situation and just get it immediately and bang out a solution, was pretty much losing us money because he had the highest salary. He was an amazing developer, a great guy. And we built him out at the same rate we built everybody out at. And we could barely keep him busy because he was so fast. And then our most junior person, who was basically an intern, was really slow, needed a lot of help, a lot of rework, a lot of refactoring. But he was a delightful person. His customers loved him and he kept them perfectly happy. And he made almost pretty much exactly half of what our best guy did. Same hourly rate, took him twice as long. So we're making like four times the money on an intern, basically, than we were on a world-class developer. And I was like, something's wrong here. This can't be right. And it took me, it's amazing to think back on it, but it took me a solid 2 weeks of thinking about the problem before it even occurred to me to think about not billing by the hour and using a different approach. And if you change that one thing, which is a big thing, but if you change that one thing, everything falls into place, you know, like all of a sudden your best guy is actually making you the most money, you know? So that seemed to make a lot more sense to me.
I've certainly thought about that before. You know, the small consulting firms are almost encouraged to be inefficient.
I'd say I would take the almost out of there.
I mean, it really, really pays to not be that great at your job in those kinds of situations, which really stinks for the clients. You end up with really bad relationships.
Yeah. Why would you ever upgrade your computers if you're getting paid by the hour?
The other issue with that is also that as humans, we're inherently bad at estimating. So if we're estimating and billing and setting expectations to our clients that this project or this feature is going to take so many hours, so many hundreds of hours. And then if you blow that estimate just sky high and end up billing them twice as many hours for the same, essentially the same amount of work, then they're going to be very unhappy with you.
Yeah. I'm sure anybody listening who's billed by the hour for a big project has had that experience. And then it turns into this thing where maybe the client doesn't blame you. Maybe they know that they've, you know, drag the scope all over the place and they've changed the goalposts or moved the goalposts. Maybe they know that and they don't blame you, but they're still not happy about the investment. They still would potentially regret the whole thing because it could certainly have ended up costing more than it was even worth to them. But once they're that far down the path, by the time you realize that there's a problem, it's, you know, you're halfway or more than halfway into a project. So there's this like, well, I guess we might as well just finish it now. Cause if we kill it, then we lose all the money. But if we keep going, we'll probably lose less money. So it's a question of how do we lose less money? And at the end of that, it's not like, it's just a bad emotional situation all the way around.
Yeah, it's a terrible question to ask. You know, you should be asking, how can you make the most money? Not how can you lose the least amount?
Right. And when I talk to people who bill by the hour, almost everybody doesn't really bill by the hour. They're certainly not strict about it. They usually are, you know, not charging the client for, say, researching something that they feel they should have known, some sort of, you know, like nuance of React or whatever, that they feel like, oh, I should have known that. I can't bill them for learning React. Or there might be something about the customer's industry that they think is no big deal. They underestimate the business logic of a particular thing and they didn't really work it into the estimate and they feel bad about it. So they don't put those on the timesheet. They don't put those on the invoice. Or straight up, if people think something took them too long, like maybe I think I'm a hotshot Laravel coder and I look at a task in my list and I'm like, that should take me about an hour, and it ends up being some surprises and it takes 6 hours. And I just personally, as a Laravel craftsperson, I think, that shouldn't have taken me that long. It's not fair to them for me to bill them for the 6 hours that really should have taken me 1 hour. So most people who bill by the hour are eating hours all over the place anyway, of their own accord, never mind the ones they forget to log. And then at the end of the project, if it's over, then you can always, there's always that conversation where the consumer turns into a micromanaging nightmare, you know, client from hell type of thing, because you've gone way over estimate. So they start to lose confidence in you and they start micromanaging every little thing. They go over every single invoice with a fine tooth comb. And now you're talking about hours almost as, you know, people like, I should start billing for the conversations we're having about hours, you know, because they start, takes up so much time. So you end up eating hours for a million reasons, because intuitively we know as people that there's like a fair, like there's a fair, there's something is fair and something's not fair. So you're probably not already in a very mercenary type of way billing for all your hours. So, you know, maybe making that an explicit thing instead of an implicit thing is something to think about.
So that makes me think of, and I don't know if you call it this, but essentially fixed billing. And years ago, fixed billing was looked down on from the consultant side because, I mean, as John pointed out earlier, humans are really, really bad at estimating things. You know, we're okay with relative estimates, but going, oh, that's going to take 3 months. Mm-hmm. We're really, really terrible at that. And the problem that a lot of people have said with fixed billing is that if you say it's going to take 3 months and it really takes 6 months, then you are eating that 3 months of money that you could have had. One is what you're suggesting. Do you consider it fixed billing? And two, how do you handle the blown estimates?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great questions. So one thing I want to point out is the difference between billing and pricing. So what I'm talking about is pricing. Billing is something where you sort of back your way into a price at the end of the project. So the price ends up being however much money changed hands over the 3 to 6 months. Ends up that the price was $100,000. We estimated it was going to be $50,000, but we were wrong. So the price you ultimately paid was $100,000. But nobody ever priced as a verb. Nobody ever priced that project. They merely estimated it. So what you're talking about is fixed pricing. And I'm a huge fan of fixed pricing, but there's two main ways to calculate a fixed price. And the way that most people do it is what gets them into the trouble that you're describing. So folks who have attempted fixed pricing on projects almost always get burned because they calculate the price based on time and materials. So they essentially do an estimate and then they tack on some random percentage for project management. You know, so they say, it's going to take me 100 hours, be, you know, X dollars per hour, multiply it by 15%, tack that on top, and then give that as a price. You've got a disaster waiting to happen there because people are bad at estimating how much time it's going to take them to do something, and they're bad at even knowing what they're going to do. Probably nobody here does waterfall projects. Probably no one, you know, maybe someone listening does waterfall projects, but that's probably not what we're talking about here. Seems like that's more of a thing of the past, and it's more common to do kind of agile type development where you're learning as you go and you're correcting along the way. The alternative is to base your price on the value of the business outcome to the client instead of how much work it's going to take you to do. And what that means is finding out in advance, before you start work at all, before you even present a proposal, you find out what they're trying to achieve. No client needs more code. Quick, we need more code. They need code that's going to do something for them. They think that it's going to have some kind of business outcome. This is a B2B situation. They're not commissioning you because to write a bunch of immaculate code that they're going to frame and hang on the wall. They don't care about the code. I mean, yeah, they recognize that you're going to have to code to build the new customer service dashboard, but they don't care about that. They want the customer service dashboard. So if you're an Ember developer, and they say, hey, we've got an Ember app. We understand that you do Ember development. Could we talk about hiring you to do some work for us? And the question of what do they want you to do, the word do, is super vague. It can mean something, it almost surely means something different to the Ember developer than it does to the person who's hiring the Ember developer. Who knows? There's just so many assumptions going on. Like the Ember developer probably thinks they're going to be hired to do Ember development. But the client doesn't really want Ember development. It's as this sort of abstract concept. They probably want a particular feature built, or they want to be able to release code more quickly, or they need some new module or something like that, which is closer to the desired business outcome. But if you keep talking to them, he's like, well, why do you want that? Why don't you not do that? Why don't you save all this money from hiring someone expensive like me to build that? What's in it for you? You know, I only want to work with customers who are going to get a positive ROI from working with me, so then we can work together for a long time. So why do you care about this customer service dashboard, for example? Well, you know, the CEO, the customer service people are just totally on the CEO's back, and we really want to get them off the CEO's back. Oh, really? Why? Are they upset about something? Yeah, they can't get anything done. They can't respond to these queries, and they feel bad, and it's bad for the brand. It's, oh, okay, so their morale is bad. Do they quit a lot? Do you have to constantly replace them? Yeah, a little bit, but it's more that, you know, they're just upset that they can't resolve customer issues as quickly as they know is possible. Oh, so the customers are starting to feel the pain of this. Yeah. Oh, are you losing any customers over it? Well, probably. They don't want you to sit there and code for them. They don't want you to sit there at the computer and just press keys. They want their customers to be happier. They want their brand to be better. They want their employee morale to be better. There's something in there somewhere that clients want. And almost always you can attach a rough idea of what that might be worth to a particular business. And if you articulate that and say, all right, so what I'm hearing is X, Y, and Z, you know, if you lose one customer per year for a company like you, that's got to be at least a $50,000 hit. We can solve this problem a bunch of different ways, including Ember development, but there's some other things we could probably do. It's tough to say, but we could look at the code base and find out. It might be an easy fix here. Now, all of a sudden, you're talking about what it's worth to them instead of how hard it's going to be for you to do it, how much typing you have to do, or how many contractors you're going to have to pay to execute this. So all of a sudden, if you're thinking like, okay, this is probably, let's say it's a $50,000 problem for this client, you know, annually. All right, so I can come up with a few prices based on that. They have to be lower than that. I can't give them an estimate for $150,000 for this $50,000 problem. It doesn't make sense. So I could give them a price of like a $5,000 thing, maybe a $12,000 thing, and maybe a $50,000 thing, a $45,000 thing. Say, okay, there are three ways we could tackle this problem. The lowest one is the least likely to succeed, but it's low-hanging fruit. We could do it really quickly, and it'll move the ball, you know, down the field for you. Or we could do this cooler thing. It's not soup to nuts, but it's more likely to succeed, more likely to have a positive impact in the near term. And then, you know, the soup to nuts Mercedes option here, where we basically come in, take over all of the, you know, remove all the bottlenecks that, you know, your staff's got a job that they need to do. They don't need to be working on this project all day too. So we can come in, staff it up a little bit, remove the bottlenecks, and, you know, achieve these outcomes in this amount of time, you know, roughly for this amount of money. So now all of a sudden you're talking like a business person about, you know, them investing in their business to achieve this desired business outcome. And you're not talking about like, oh, how many, what's the object model going to be like? And how many screens are there going to be? And what color do you want the logo to be? None of that stuff matters. You can figure that out later. To wrap that up, I'm talking about a different way to come up with a price for a fixed price project. Almost everybody does time and materials, which I think that's what you were alluding to earlier. This is a completely different way. It's basing it on value. And when you do that, it changes the entire conversation before the sale. When you're talking about hours, what do you ask? You ask like, oh, how many lines of code are there now? What plugins are you using? What gems are you using? Who's the host? You're asking yourself all of these problems. So you're trying to calculate how hard your life's going to be. And you're not thinking at all or very little about how what you do is going to make the client's life better. But if you come at it this other way, that's all you think about. You don't even think about what you're going to do until you have some prices set up. And then you're like, okay, what could I do for these people for $10,000 that would make their life better? So then you can think about, it's not a question about estimating the time. It's about backing your way into a scope instead of backing your way into a price.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think that it's, I've definitely seen places where it's missing, where you're not kind of calculating that scope and kind of approaching it from the business value perspective. But what happens when you have to, like, you aren't going to be able to fulfill that project? The scope is larger than something you're going to, so you're going to now have to hire people to be able to do this. At what point, so at some point, their time and materials, or do you hire them only through the smaller scoped part of the project that they're going to be working on?
I've seen both. I think both can work. The thing that a lot of people can't get their heads around when we talk about this sort of thing is that most people are used to razor thin margins. When you have, and if this project, whatever the project is not that valuable to the client, you can't take it. Like, so there's a possibility, like value pricing cuts both ways. So if you come in and they say, oh, you know, we really need this customer service dashboard because we're losing clients because of our bad customer service. And this dashboard, we believe having that would change that. And that's only worth, and it's a small company, and it's maybe a one person company or a two person company, and they haven't got any money, and the clients that they're talking about are paying them $9 a month. And you see that it's a giant amount of work for you. You can't just say, oh, well, that'll be $100,000. And obviously, you know, because right. The value is not there. So you just pass on the project because there's no, I mean, maybe there's some tiny thing that you can do for them. Maybe you can point them at some, you know what I mean? So you start with the value roughly, and you say, oh, this is definitely a million dollar problem that we're solving here, or this is definitely a $10,000 problem that we're solving here. So whatever price you come up with has to be below that. It has to be under it. And if you want to make it a no-brainer, you make it significantly under that. So now what do I do if I can't, there's maybe some piece where I'm not an expert. Maybe it's, a D3 visualization that needs to be, I don't do D3. I don't know anything about it. I know React maybe, and I just don't, I don't know anything, you know, and I don't feel like figuring it out. I could go hire someone for that or not. I could hire them by the hour. Almost certainly I could find someone to do that. Or I could give somebody, say, hey, D3 people, I've got $1,000 for anybody that can do X, Y, and Z, and people can throw their hat in the ring. You could do it either way, but the thing that has to be there for either one to work is a gigantic margin on your side. So if the project is going to take you a week and it's a $1 million problem, and you say to the client, look, we guarantee we can make this work and that you're going to see a positive return on investment. It'll be $100,000 and we can have it done in a week. Then you've got all kinds of money to play with to go out, and it doesn't matter if you pay them hourly because you're not going to lose money because there's so much upside.
I see.
So yeah, if most people are used to thinking about razor thin margins because people never tack on profit. They just think like, oh, you know, you got to pay me $150 to get out of bed in the morning. I'm not doing anything for less than $150 an hour. But they don't. That, to me, that's their cost. That's like the cost of them spending an hour engaging in activities on the client's behalf. No one really thinks about profit. Like they just think, oh, some portion of that's profit, I guess, or they think it's all profit, but it's really not.
I would say a fair amount of our listeners are working in perhaps a corporate environment and thinking about taking on additional work, side work, or just breaking out into a solo entrepreneurial role and going out on their own. Is how do you make that transition and how do you start to change that personal mindset? Because as corporate developers, they're usually answering the question of how long will this feature take you to make? The value and the cost conversations are often happening outside of any meeting that you're involved in. So how do you change that mindset and how do you start having those conversations with any potential clients?
Good question. Big question. So when I think back to when I was in-house, if I was going to do it over again to go out on my own, there are a lot of things I would do differently. And one of the things I would do differently for sure is I would start building an audience. You could call it building an audience or leading a tribe, Seth Godin would say, but I would start doing that while I was still in-house. I'm not talking about just getting a million Twitter followers. I'm talking about like finding people who need my expertise, whose lives will be improved by my expertise, and giving it away to them for free. So maybe it would be a mailing list, maybe it would be a blog, maybe it would be webinars, but it would be something where I could sort of put my expertise into the world and find out if anybody values it, or if they could even connect the dots from what I do to what they need. I describe like, imagine talking to a physical therapist and you say, oh, what do you do? It's like, oh, I jam my thumbs into people's muscles until they scream. It's like, okay, that's like one way to talk about it. That's the way developers usually talk about what they do. The other way to talk about it is I help pro baseball pitchers get back in the game after an injury. It's like, oh, this person does the exact, like in their mind, they are doing the exact same thing. They're jamming their thumbs into somebody's calf, but that would be weird for a pitcher, but okay. Not really a sports guy, but they're describing the activities that the first example, they're describing the activities that they engage in. First, I go like this, then I go like this, then I go like this. And they neglect to talk about why or what the benefit is or who they might do it for. But if you don't even talk about physical therapy and you say, oh, I help professional pitchers get back in the game after they're sidelined by an injury.
Oh, really?
I know a professional pitcher. I know somebody that works for the Red Sox, or I know, you know, Bob, maybe I should introduce you. It's a completely different, discussion. So the thing I would do if I was still in-house is I would figure out that. What is that thing? How can I take my calf rubbing and put it in a way that the people who need it the most, the people who are going to value that expertise the most are going to benefit from it. I would figure that out and try to start attracting those people with just free content, podcast, webinar, mailing list, whatever.
If I remember correctly, you were focused primarily on mobile banking. Is that correct?
Yeah. So in 2010, I wrote a book called Building iPhone Apps with HTML, CSS, and JavaScript for O'Reilly. And it was really one of the very first of its kind that tackled that. And it was perfect. It was just lucky. It was perfect timing. And I was positioned sort of de facto as an expert at that when it was still a very small pond. There were very few people doing that. iPhone had just come out and people were really starting to take it seriously. So for a long time, I was doing just general, it was specifically mobile work, but it was for any industry. So mostly customer facing, like retail, but still there were, you know, Cisco, Intel, Nokia. There were internal types of projects. There were external projects, and I would get brought in to help them decide whether or not they should use like an HTML, CSS, JavaScript plus PhoneGap type of approach, or just go pure mobile web, or go native cross-platform? Like, oh, do we use Titanium Accelerator or like Xamarin, or like, should we use any of these, or should we just go pure native on both platforms? These days, people would be asking these questions about React if I still did it. About, I guess it was, what year is this, 2018? So I think in 2017, as an experiment, I focused on specifically on a vertical to explore that industry. And it was credit unions, because I had one or two credit union clients at the time. I can't remember. And so I went into that space. I made a lot of connections. I researched it. And ultimately, I decided that it wasn't going to be a great fit, because the industry is extremely risk averse. And what I was asking them to do was perceived as extremely risky, a big investment, a big change, and the kind of thing that they would rather get from a third-party vendor, just like, give us something off the shelf that we can pay for by the month. So if I was going to actually, if I was going to stay in consulting and stay in the financial space, I'd go after the third-party platforms like Fiserv, for example. It's one of the biggest SaaSs in the entire world, and most people outside of the industry have never even heard of it. But that's where all the money is, and they're in desperate need of mobile user experience. You know, so if anybody out there is mobile UX expert, go after Fiserv because they need it. Sorry, Fiserv.
So you essentially set yourself up as an expert in a narrowly focused vertical and took the broader concept of mobile web development and really narrowly focused to make that conversation a little bit more focused and making sure that you're picking the correct clients and that you're able to deliver the value that they need.
Right. So it's just another way to sort of optimize your delivery and decrease your marketing and decrease your costs. So now if I can walk into a credit union and understand their regulatory environment and how they're going to have to get things approved and what their board is going to say, I can like boom, 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 much more quickly than somebody who's just like, I'm smart. I can learn the constraints of the credit union industry on the fly. So you can imagine on my website and then in a proposal or a sales meeting and then in a proposal and then in the actual delivery of the project, I'm going to have a huge leg up over anybody that is just like, oh, I can hit the ground running. I'm smart. You know, it's just, you're just not even speaking their language. So there's automatically going to be a trust bond between me and a potential client over somebody who's just a general web developer, general mobile web developer. But that's just one way to think about it. Like there are plenty of people who have a very strong horizontal specialization where they're just well known as being a global expert at React Native. Or, I have a student who calls himself a cloud economist, and he helps people reduce their horrifying AWS bills. So he picked a space where there's a clear tie to the bottom line. He can make an impact extremely quickly. He just comes in, runs a sort of set of diagnostics. He does interviews and he's got this outcome. And it's like, oh, you could save $1 million a year. Here's how you do it. And if you want to, if you want me to, there might be some development effort, some engineering effort involved to make these changes, but here's how you could do it. And oh, by the way, if you want me to oversee the project when you do make those changes, then we can talk about that too. So yeah, I mean, you can do really either way. It can be horizontal, it can be vertical. You could focus on a particular demographic, like people who believe that global warming is real or people who don't believe that global warming is real. You could pick any kind of demographic, psychographic, vertical, industry vertical, or perhaps horizontal. Just be out there like an expert at, React, let's say.
Very cool. Well, thank you. One of the things we kind of also try to focus on is just advice specifically for people who are kind of getting started. And maybe this would be, we kind of talked a little bit about getting started as an independent. Would you recommend that people getting into the industry try to jump into freelancing from the beginning, or would you recommend them sort of more try to take a traditional approach, or does it matter?
Hard to say. It's kind of case by case. I think that when I was in-house, I thought I knew everything about FileMaker, up, down, and sideways. That was like my area of expertise. I had a high degree of confidence, you could call it arrogance maybe, that I was the bee's knees at FileMaker. And then I went into a consulting company where we had all sorts of different clients instead of my essentially one client that I worked for. And I was like, oh yeah, I've never done this on PCs. I don't know anything about FileMaker on PCs. So an entire half of the industry I had no clue about, and there were significant differences. In that sense, it probably would have been I guess what I'm saying is that I learned a lot. I thought I had nothing or little left to learn. It turns out I had tons left to learn. So I was kind of an idiot. I had some skills, but really not that many. And when I had my eyes open to that by going in-house at a boutique consultancy, I also learned how to deal with clients, so, you know, much more in a more professional way than I would have had to at a job. So it's hard to say, like, if you know that you aren't there yet, freelancing is a pretty hard road. You're kind of asking yourself, you're throwing yourself in the way deep end of the pool, because when people think, oh, I'll just start freelancing, it's like, well, you just started a business, and part of business is marketing, and part of business is sales, and part of business is client satisfaction and all that stuff. And if all you know is your craft, that's a lot to learn. Which isn't to say don't do it, but I think for me, the safety net for me, if I was going to do it over again, would be to have a connection with a group of people who valued what it was that I did. And that means figuring out how to talk about what I do in a way that's valuable to people who don't do what I do. And figuring that out is huge, and you can start doing it at any point. So I would really start trying to attract an audience as early as possible. And it's easy to do as a side hustle when you're getting, you know, you got a salary coming in and it's fun. So that would be the first thing I would do. Possibly I would go in-house somewhere else at a true consulting firm immediately after I left my employer and before I started freelancing. But you could potentially skip that. If you had a big audience and you were very clear on the value you delivered, and you had tapped into a market that had lots of capital, you could probably do it.
Awesome. Do you, I believe you're on Twitter. Is there other places that people might be able to find you?
Sure. The best place to get in touch with me is through my mailing list, which you can read more about at valuepricingbootcamp.com. Gets into all the things we've been talking about here today in a lot more detail. But yep, I'm also on Twitter, and I don't know if I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I'm becoming much more active on LinkedIn for some reason. LinkedIn is like turning into a kind of a fun place to hang out. I mean, I used to be like, ooh, but it seems to have changed in the last couple of years. It's much more fun. So LinkedIn, Twitter, but my mailing list is the place if you really want to interact. I constantly in conversations with my list.
Thank you, Jonathan. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, anytime. My pleasure.
That was Jonathan Stark. Jonathan is a former software developer who is now on a mission to rid the world of hourly billing. He is the author of Hourly Billing is Nuts, the host of Ditching Hourly, and writes a daily newsletter on pricing for independent consultants.
If you like this episode, please like, rate, and review on iTunes.
Find show notes, blog posts, and more at sixfiguredev.com.
Be sure to follow us on Twitter at sixfiguredev.
This has been another episode of the Six Figure Developer Podcast, helping others reach their potential.
I am John Calloway.
I'm Clayton Hunt.
And I'm John Ash.